Now, if you visit Villasbretina today and you go to the local school that was rebuilt thanks to donations from Victorian school children, you'll see in each classroom and outside on the roof of what was called in my day the shelter shed, the words, N'oublions jamais l'Australie. Never forget Australia. The aim of this talk is to explain why those words are there. Now, this concerns a time that was immensely significant in the history of the world, never mind Australia, and what happened at Villabretina is an important part of it. But to fully appreciate its significance, you need to be aware of the background context. So I'll start with this arresting sentence. 1917 was the worst year in Australian history since European settlement. Because it's important, and you might be a little bit distracted, I should say that again. 1917 was the worst year in Australian history since European settlement. Australia had more casualties in 1917 than in any other year of this or any other war. 77,000 casualties, 22,000 deaths, compared to, say, 8 months at Gallipoli, where there were around 26,000 casualties and a little over 8,000 deaths. Australians in 1917 spent their longest periods in the front line, incurred their worst defeats, and lost more prisoners captured than in any other year of the war. New faraway place names became seared into the nation's consciousness in 1917. Bullecourt, Messines, Menin Road, Polygon Wood, Broodside, Passchendaele, all associated with ghastly slaughter and dread for Australian families. After more than 3 years of this terrible conflict, it seemed that an end to it was as far away as ever. The war seemed like a raging juggernaut of destruction, indiscriminately smashing men and women, hopes and dreams. Whoops. How do we move to the next one? Oh, the arrow, sorry. Me and technology. Thank you, Don. Now that's Polygon Wood. That's the landscape at Polygon Wood. And it was not just a matter of appalling casualties in big battles. We should not neglect to remember this. Simply occupying the trenches in horrendous winter conditions, mud, slime, lice, rats, freezing cold weather and all the rest, was a grim ordeal that substantially damaged Australians' morale. And back home, the nation had been left bitterly divided over the 1917 conscription referendum. There were two conscription referendums in 1916 and 1917. Perhaps I should call them plebiscites. Both were ferociously contested and generated tremendous divisiveness. There was also a big strike in New South Wales in 1917, affecting many workers. The fierce action taken by governments, federal and New South Wales, to smash the strike accentuated the bitter divisiveness. In fact, Australia has never been more bitterly and profoundly divided than during World War I. Now, this harrowing and melancholy state of affairs was exemplified by a letter that Australia's most famous fighting general, Pompey Elliott, wrote to his wife, Kate. That's Pompey. Here it's the last day of this sad old year, 1917. I think it has held more of sadness and disappointment than any other year of my life. I am particularly in the blues today. It is bitterly cold, and there is nearly a couple of feet of snow on the ground. There have been no home letters for more than a month. It is very sad not getting any letters. I expect there will be a big fight as soon as things get a bit drier. I am big heap lonely for you, Katie. Information from prisoners confirmed that an immense German offensive was indeed imminent. It became increasingly likely that the German assault would not begin where the AIF was located. So most Australian soldiers, realised that their task would be to stop enemy infantry advancing across terrain that would probably be relatively open. Many had enlisted, at least in part, to stop the Germans rampaging across Europe, and it was satisfying to feel that this would now be their role. Instead of the usually ill-conceived attacks the AIF had been making one after the other for years. The Australians were confident they were superior to the enemy as soldiers, and some openly welcomed the German advance. In fact, Pompey Elliott observed that there's a feeling in the air that we're all glad he is coming. This attitude was typified by Charles Bean, who you're looking at there. Charles Bean, the Australian official correspondent, who was, everyone here I'm sure knows, was to become as well the official AIF historian. When the Germans launched their offensive on the 21st of March 1918, that's 100 years ago tomorrow, 100 years ago tomorrow, Bean was jubilant. My heart and spirits jumped up 100 degrees. So the German was attacking after all. He was really going to do it. The bombardment was on a front of over 50 miles. One hoped almost beyond hope that they would try to end the war by an offensive this year. And they are doing it. One does not for a moment believe that they will succeed. The attack always loses more men than the defence. They'll get 5, 10, perhaps 15 miles, but at the end of it, their army will be brought up against an unbroken wall. It is not an easy time for the actual battalions in the line, but one cannot help rejoicing. Delight soon turned to concern, however, and then alarm. The Germans succeeded in driving the British well back. Day after day came news of ominous advances, particularly in the Somme region. British formations were retiring in disarray. Even the strategically important city of Amiens looked under threat. Amiens was more than 40 miles, that's 40 miles from the pre-offensive front line, but there was still no sign of the unbroken wall that Charles Bean had confidently expected. The Commander-in-Chief publicly described the situation as a crisis. After years of hideous casualties that would blight a generation, a grim prospect loomed. Vera Brittain, the British nurse who was to become one of the most celebrated memoirists of the era, emphasised in her famous book Testament of Youth. Now, there'd be hardly anyone here who hasn't heard of Testament of Youth. Yeah, very familiar with that. This is what she wrote, emphasised in that book the crushing tension of those extreme days when into our minds had crept for the first time the secret incredible fear that we might lose the war. The Australians followed these developments with growing concern. Some became impatient to be transferred to where the action was. Eventually, they were. Monash's 3rd Division was directed to plug an alarming gap caused by a rattled British Corps commander, that's very senior, a rattled British Corps commander who had reacted to a direction provisionally outlining the procedure in the event of a withdrawal as if it was actually an order to retire. Pompey Elliott's 15th Brigade was directed to occupy the village of Hedoville after an all-night tramp, cold and rainy night, but found a collection of British stragglers in occupation who were reluctant to leave. Pompey had to threaten to evict them by force before they departed. Just hours later, though, after they'd got that British detachment out of Hedoville, Another emergency required Pompey's brigade to proceed immediately to Corbie, a town close to Amiens. Corbie and the nearby town of Villebretonneux were both 10 miles east of Amiens. The 15th Brigade was now to be placed temporarily under Monash's command. This gruelling all-night march was particularly demanding for Pompey's men after their previous night's marching had left them tired and drenched. "They will never get here," lamented a staff officer at Monash's HQ. But they did, despite their exhaustion, and Pompey was immensely proud of them. In fact, he said after the war that, "I've never been prouder." Many had kept marching, though practically asleep. Pompey was soon cracking the whip in characteristic fashion. He was appalled to find some British officers were more interested in looking for what they could loot than in fighting the enemy. With the officers out of control, it was impossible to discipline their men. When a British captain was apprehended in Corbie with a mess cart full of looted champagne, Pompey decided that enough was enough. He circulated a notice declaring that the next officer caught looting would be summarily and publicly hanged in the Corbie Market Square, and his body would be left swinging as a deterrent. Looting ceased immediately. Pompey, who was a solicitor in civilian life, concluded that none seemed inclined to make of themselves a test case. The Germans attacked again towards Amiens on April the 4th. They established themselves in Hamel and advanced ominously beyond. Dispirited British infantrymen fell back in large numbers. In contrast, Pompey's men, other AIF units, and British cavalry formations defended resolutely against superior numbers. Charles Bean was on the scene south of Corbie near Villebretonneux, that crucial town that overlooked Amiens, and Bean became so concerned that Villebretonneux was about to be lost that he called at Elliot's headquarters personally to warn him. Now, in fact, the 9th Australian Brigade retrieved the situation there, securing the vital town in dashing style, just in time, in what has sometimes been described as the first battle of Villebretonneux. Meanwhile, Elliot's 15th Brigade did just as superbly near Corbie, where his men thwarted the German assault, although immensely outnumbered. According to Pompey, his 59th Battalion was opposed by no fewer than three German divisions, so in the hierarchy, battalion, brigade, division, says three divisions, 12 battalions in a division. That gives you some idea of how much they were outnumbered. His 59th Battalion was opposed by no fewer than three German divisions advancing in depth, but Pompey's words here, "The reception their leading files got turned the stomach of all who should have followed, and they concluded that they had urgent business elsewhere." In fact, Pompey pointed out, his brigade actually gained ground there despite being so outnumbered. Monash praised Elliot and his brigade in the highest terms for what they did while under his command. "Nothing could have been more splendid," Monash declared. Now, what we're focusing on here is the climax of the biggest war there had ever been, and Australians are playing a significant role. And not just Monash's division and Pompey's brigade, it's the AIF generally. Although the German advance is beginning to overextend, the Australians' resolve and resourcefulness are influential, and in a nationally distinctive way. Non-Australian observers notice this and acclaim it. Distressed French civilians, vacating homes threatened by the German advance, react with delight when they realise the AIF has arrived in their district. Some Australians distribute nonchalant reassurance. Some of you have heard where I'm going now before. I think Some Australians distribute nonchalant reassurance. Fini retreat, madame. Beaucoup Australians, EC. No more retreat, madame. Many Australians here. Now, that's got to be one of the all-time great national statements, surely. Fini retreat, madame. Beaucoup Australians, EC. Many civilians, confident that the Australians will resist the Germans, turn around, retrace their steps, and reoccupy their homes amid rapturous cries of Vive l'Australie! Now, that's a drawing. This is, in my, as far as I'm aware, the only image of this important part of the Australian story. It's a drawing by Will Dyson, who was there. Australia's first official war artist. He was there. Now, the key to the drawing, it seems to me, is the beckoning of the woman prominent at the front on the right, who is, as I interpret it, encouraging other French civilians who had abandoned their homes to turn around and reoccupy them, go back to them, because the Australians have arrived. Yeah. Australia's soldiers, bolstering resistance in vulnerable sectors despite the demoralised disarray they mostly encounter, are aware they are different and aware they are making a difference. And yet, this is why I started where I did. Yet, this is happening straight after the worst year Australia has ever known. The worst casualties Australia has suffered in any year in this or any other war. Remarkably, what the AIF did in 1918, in both these weeks of desperate defence and also the contrasting phase in the second half of the year, when they spearheaded the prolonged offensive that brought eventual victory, what the AIF did in 1918 prompts the conclusion that Australians were influencing the destiny of the world in 1918 more than Australians had ever done before or have ever done since, in any other year. 1918 more than any other year. And the culmination of the Australians' contribution during the earlier phase of desperate defence was the celebrated exploit at Villebretten that I'll get to very soon. Now, first, though, I should make clear that I make these observations about 1918 as someone who feels strongly that World War I was a disaster for Australia. I don't agree with the sentiment you sometimes hear that World War I made Australia, because those who say this mean the war made Australia in a positive sense. If World War I did make Australia, it was in a negative sense. All those ghastly casualties, the loss of so many of Australia's brightest and best, the critical rupture of Australia's social harmony and cohesion, the damage to Australia's sense of collective national optimism, and the sentiment historian Bill Gammage had in mind when he described the war's aftermath like this. Dreams abandoned, lives without purpose, women without husbands, families without family life, one long national funeral for a generation and more after 1918. Unquote from Bill. Now, having said that, if we're going to focus on what Australia's soldiers did and what they accomplished, my view is that while we make a big fuss of Gallipoli, and that's understandable because it came first, we should make a much bigger fuss of 1918 than we do. What the Australians did in 1918 should be much better known than it is. Pompey Elliott's morale had been very low at the end of 1917, just a few months earlier. But all his drive and verve returned as his brigade became front and centre in dramatic events in this climax of the war. What he wrote at the time reflected his transformed morale. The AIF have hitherto accomplished nothing to be compared in importance with the work they have in hand just now. I was never so proud of being an Australian as I am today. The gallant bearing and joyous spirit of the men at the prospect of a fight thrills you through and through. You simply cannot despair or be downhearted. Whatever the odds against you, when you feel their spirits rising, the more the danger seems to threaten. It is glorious indeed to be with them. I cannot tell you where we are, because of the censorship, but think of what the Boche most aimed for and plant my brigade right across the path. It is a great honour, I feel, to be placed there. We will hold him yet. You must tell everyone to keep their spirits up. This is no time for softness and yielding. The boys are longing for him to come on. The more we see of him as a soldier, the more contemptuous of him do we become. His strategy and his tactics appear alike to have been copied from the locusts that devastate our fields at home on occasion. The whole military ability of the Teutonic race has advanced no plan beyond the instinct of an infant grasshopper. In spots he must gain by such means a transient success. Now, remember, the British have been driven back no less than 40 miles in a war that, where there's been hardly any movement for 3 years. So it's perhaps a touch more than transient. Anyhow, that's what he wrote. In spots he must gain by such means a transient success. But will he win the war? Never, if our hearts are stout and our brains cool and our arms ready to take advantage of opportunity. I must just stick it out like my boys. Our backs to the wall, but our faces and our breasts undaunted at all, facing the foe. Never fear the ultimate result. So you get a sense of the frame of mind that he's in. Yeah, just before Villers-Bret. Pompey wrote these stirring words at his brigade's headquarters at Blangy-Tronville in front of Amiens. Amiens was the main German objective he was referring to in that letter when he wrote, "Think of what the Boche most aimed for and plant my brigade right across the path." Amiens. His 15th Brigade, which had rejoined the 5th AIF Division after its temporary stint under Monash, was now in reserve, not far away from Villers-Bretonneux, which is the elevated town that was the key to the city of Amiens and its strategically vital railway network. For those of you who've been to Villers-Bret, if you visited the Australian National Memorial on the hill alongside the town, and it was a clear day when you did, you could have seen in the distance yourselves the city of Amiens. And it's very evident that if you had control of Villers-Bret and that nearby hill, your artillery would be able to imperil the defence of Amiens. The commander of the British 4th Army, General Henry Rawlinson, now here's where we get into this one. Now, I might now and again have to come round. Those of you at the back might struggle to see that, might you? Yes. Yeah, okay. So Rawlinson is there, okay? I'll be coming back and referring to this now and again in what I'm about to say about the battle itself. That's Rawlinson, the British 4th Army commander. He had instigated a rearrangement that took effect on the 20th of April 1918, the 20th of April. Under this rearrangement, the British 3rd Corps was allocated the task of safeguarding Villers-Bretonneux. There's the 3rd Corps there, commanded by Butler. These are British units down here. So Butler's 3rd Corps was allocated the task of safeguarding Villers-Bretonneux. Pompey was convinced that the Germans would make another attempt to capture Villers-Bret. He was also coming rapidly to the conclusion that when the Germans attacked, the British would be unable to hold the town and his nearby brigade would be called on to recapture it. This perception was reinforced when he found that the 8th British Division under General Hennecker, there's Hennecker, right, Rawlinson here, remember? There's Butler, 3rd Corps, Hennecker here, 8th British Division, Hennecker. When Pompey found that the 8th British Division under General Hennecker which had arrived to safeguard Villa Bretonneux as part of Rawlinson's rearrangement, was doing so with faulty dispositions that endangered Pompey's own men in the process. Pompey objected forcefully to his immediate superior, General Hobbs, who's the commander of the 5th AIF Division. Now, if we come over to this side, the Australians, there's Hobbs, 5th Division, Birdwood, above, commanding the Australian Corps. There's Pompey, there, 15th AIF Brigade, and there are his battalions. Yeah, 57th, 58th, 59th, 60th, under Pompey Elliott at Villa's Bret, and he's under Hobbs. Okay? Hobbs, so just recapping, Pompey objected forcefully to the British dispositions. He objected forcefully to his immediate superior, Hobbs, who the commander of the 5th AIF Division. Hobbs was sympathetic and raised the matter with the British 3rd Corps. Remember, over there, he raised it with Butler. Hobbs is one level lower. But there we are. But he got in touch with Butler and said, basically, politely, Hobbs is a very polite commander. He's the opposite of Pompey. Yeah. Hobbs would have gently said, "Are you sure your blokes are, holding that the right way, General?" Only to be informed that General Butler was aware of the dispositions and approved of them. This reinforced, and Hobbs, of course, told Pompey, this reinforced Pompey's misgivings about the British. Such a decision, that particular decision, was so ordinary that it forbade us to hope that any intelligent military action could reasonably be expected from any of them, from the corps commander down, said Pompey. Pompey and Hobbs quietly agreed that a new trench should be excavated, ostensibly for communication, but really, in fact, to protect Pompey's men. While this trench was being constructed, Pompey urged all officers in his brigade to scrutinise a contoured model of the sector that a talented corporal on Pompey Elliott's staff had created. Early on the 24th of April, just after 4 a.m, Pompey Elliott was notified that the Germans were bombarding Villa Bretonneux. He immediately informed all his battalions, and I showed you where they were. There they are, all those four battalions. There's Pompey. He immediately informed all his battalions that the expected German attack was probably underway and dispatched liaison officers to neighbouring brigades. He then issued a stream of counter-attack orders, putting into effect the plan he had devised in the expectation that the British would be driven out of Villa Bretonneux. What he had in mind was envelopment, which he had previously used successfully during the war. So what he has in mind is envelopment. He sends a pincer round one way, the other pincer round the other, and they pinch out the Germans caught in the middle. That's the essence of Pompey's plan. It's come up there. So there we are. Oh, it's got bigger though. It's got too big. How do we fix that? Good on you. Thank you. Look, he's a marvel, this guy. Tech officer. Yeah. Okay. So early on the 24th, Pompey's notified that the Germans are bombarding Villa's Bret. He informed immediately all his battalions that the expected German attack was probably underway and dispatched liaison officers to neighbouring brigades. Okay, you understand the concept of liaison officers? So they can communicate with him as events unfold what's happening at the next door headquarters. He's got a direct line to his own officer that he's planted there. He then issued a stream of counter-attack orders, putting into effect the plan he had devised in the expectation that the British would be driven out of Villa Bret. What he had in mind was envelopment, which he had previously used successfully. He directed his battalions to advance in different directions. This is the envelopment. Different directions, and then meet up east of the town, cutting off the enemy inside it in the process. There. So One pincer that way, the other pincer that way, and they're trapped inside. All this was provisional, though. Provisional, as it was not clear whether the British had been driven back, and so it was not certain that a counterattack would be necessary. Pompey, though, had no doubt that it would. Before long, it became clear that he was right. Informative messages from his liaison officers that he'd stationed at the neighbouring headquarters made it disturbingly clear that the Germans had quickly taken control of the town and were proceeding to spread out beyond it. This was alarming news, and Pompey, predictably galvanised, phoned Hobbs, his divisional commander, immediate superior, to obtain authorisation for the counterattack he had provisionally put in motion, and his men were all set to launch. Hobbs was not against this, but insisted that Pompey's brigade could not operate in the British area unless he received an urgent request from the British. The upshot was a protracted delay. Information from the 8th British Division was minimal, even after Hobbs rang Henniker directly. Remember, Henniker's the British Divisional Commander here. And this is, it's interesting that the phone records can be seen, as I did, at the Australian War Memorial, and you can see the record of Hobbs' conversation with Henniker. Hobbs said this: "Your troops have retired and our flank is in the air. Enemy is advancing from Villabretina towards Fuioi. Can we shell Villabretina? Are you going to make a counterattack?" But the 8th Division headquarters had lost touch with their units and could not say whether they would be counterattacking. Hours passed. Hours passed. The delay was immensely frustrating. The Germans would be consolidating in and around Villabretina, making the task of dislodging them increasingly difficult, and Elliot and Hobbs were both convinced that Henniker's men would be unable to rectify the situation themselves. Yet they had to wait while the British worked out whether they would attempt a counterattack. Meanwhile, Pompey, from the gist of him that you've got already, this is perhaps not a surprise when I say Pompey was pacing around his headquarters like a caged lion, waiting for permission to strike. As he wrote afterwards, "It was sticking out as plain as a pikestaff that we should have to counterattack sooner or later." He ensured that his brigade derived some benefit from the delay by directing that as many officers as possible should go forward and familiarise themselves with the ground ahead. Henniker eventually authorised a counterattack by his own men. That's the 8th British Division commander. Eventually authorised a counterattack by his men. Pompey advised his battalion commanders. This is the message he sent to them. "Stand fast, as British are endeavouring to restore line themselves, but be ready for instant action." However, this British counterattack did not eventuate, and nor did a series of other counterattacks that Henniker ordered various battalions in his division to undertake. So the status quo continued. Hour after hour, the Germans had control of Villabretina, were no doubt continuing to strengthen their positions in and around the town as rapidly as they could. Henniker and his 8th Division were unable to remove them, yet kept obstinately rejecting offers and suggestions of assistance. Now, lest it be thought that there's an excessively anti-British tone in all this, I'd like to point out that I'm... Just touch this. Yeah. Come on, behave. Yeah. I'd like to point out that I'm telling the story straight here. It's what happened. It's what happened. But I'd also like to emphasise that the British at Villabretina had endured an undeniably harrowing ordeal. The German bombardment at dawn of the 24th had been ferocious and followed up by tanks, and the young British reinforcements positioned there as a result of General Rawlinson's unwise rearrangement certainly had a terrifying experience. Meanwhile, while Henniker and his headquarters were dithering and Pompey was pacing around like a caged lion, the situation was energising other headquarters further up the military hierarchy. So remember, we've got Rawlinson there, that's Douglas Haig there, and above them again, that's Foch, the Generalissimo. The news that the Germans had driven the British out of Villers Retina had caused consternation all the way up the hierarchy to the very top. Even General Foch, at the very top, told General Rawlinson bluntly that the immediate recapture of Villers Retina was an urgent priority. Rawlinson was well aware of this already, of course. He wrote a letter that afternoon saying, "We must get it back, whatever happens." And as for Haig, he reacted to the unpalatable news by proceeding directly to Rawlinson's headquarters himself. Rawlinson had already taken action of his own, directing the 13th Australian Brigade to march to Villebret immediately. Now, when this order arrived, the 13th Brigade was located in reserve 8 miles away, north of the Somme. 8 miles away, north of the Somme. Now, this pressure from above added to Hennecke's difficulties. His division was still unable to organise an effective response of its own, yet continued to ignore the offered assistance from nearby Australians. In the end, Hennecke became rattled and phoned his superior, General Butler, Hennecke Butler, and phoned Butler to confess that it was, quote, again, the phone records, impossible to arrange counter-attack as we don't know where we are and where enemy is. Hennecke had wasted a lot of invaluable time arriving at that despondent conclusion, and he was then even contemplating a withdrawal of his own headquarters. But with that admission, it was at least now clear that the necessary counter-attack would not be carried out by Hennecke's 8th Division and would therefore be undertaken by the Australians. But how would they carry it out? How would they carry it out? Working out a viable plan and all the precise consequential arrangements proved no easy task. There were protracted deliberations and discussions involving Butler, Hobbs, Hennecke, various brigadiers, including Pompey, and numerous staff officers. Eventually, a plan crystallised during the afternoon, that is, the afternoon of April the 24th. Pompey's 15th Brigade, under this plan, would advance around the north of Villers Retina, while the newly arrived 13th AIF Brigade under General Thomas Glasgow would carry out an equivalent advance south of the town. Yeah? Here's Villers Bret. Pompey around the north, Glasgow's 13th around the south. These two pincers would join up east of Villers Bret with the Germans caught inside, trapped and vanquished. And as you'll recognise, it was essentially the envelopment manoeuvre that Pompey had been vigorously advocating and itching to launch since before dawn, with the one significant difference that whereas he had envisaged his brigade forming both pincers, north and south, under the plan finally agreed, Pompey's the north, Glasgow's the south. The plan was certainly audacious. Two independent spearheads were to be launched deep into German-held territory in the dark, with meagre artillery assistance and instructions to join up with each other. Glasgow's 13th Brigade was unfamiliar with the ground and would be going into action after marching 8 miles that afternoon just to get to the rear of the battle zone. And Pompey's brigade would be undertaking a complicated manoeuvre involving three changes of direction in the dark. It was an exceptionally risky enterprise, as many anxious insiders realised. Among them was Charles Bean, on the scene as usual when a significant AIF operation was in the offing. That night he felt very pessimistic, as his diary confirms. "I don't believe they have a chance. Went to bed thoroughly depressed, feeling certain that this hurried attack would fail hopelessly." Many of Pompey's men agreed. One felt that the operation had not even the remotest chance of success. To another, it seemed an almost impossible proposition. The draining effect of prolonged suspense was another factor, prolonged suspense, which a stretcher bearer in Pompey's brigade, David Winfield, emphasised. "Since 10 last night, we have been rigged up all ready to march off to support, and now it is to counter-attack for some ground lost by the Tommies this morning. We were moving off at 10 last night, 4 a.m., 9 a.m., 1 p.m., 5, and now 7. It is a terrible time. How will men hang on at this awful cruelty? Nerves are being shredded. Men's future strength is being heavily drawn from. My nerve is weak. It's too much for mortals. However, despite his dread of the looming counterattack, he managed to steel himself to participate so effectively that he was awarded the military medal. As for Pompey himself, what he wrote afterwards about that memorable day, April the 24th, was this. I submitted the plan for recapture of a town. I was told not to bother, as the British Corps concerned were doing it themselves and it was out of my area. So for 14 hours we delayed while the Boche strengthened his position. Eventually I was solemnly handed over to the British Corps concerned, together with another Australian brigade. No means of communication with each other was provided. By this time it was pitch dark and raining, and we were launched, and our meeting place fixed within the enemy's lines, and we were left to find each other. Everyone expected the whole thing to fail, but something desperate had to be done. It was a stressful night for commanders like Pompey, as they worried and waited for news. To ease the tension, he wrote a rambling response to a recent newspaper article. This might seem a strange thing to do, he conceded, but when one has just given an order, the result of which, no matter what care or thought has been given to the preparations, means the certain death of many a dear friend, the concentration of effort required to write the essay dulls one's senses a little to what is going on. Well, what was going on while he was writing his essay? Well, things were not going according to plan. A company proceeding to its forward position at the start point lost direction after being warned to make a detour to avoid a gassed area. After waiting in vain for this company to turn up, Pompey's reorganised brigade eventually set off without it, almost 2 hours late. They hurried forward in the dark to make up for lost time, silent and resolute, taut with anticipation, excitement and dread. Who would be the unlucky ones this time? Many were aware that it was past midnight, so the Germans attacked very early on the 24th, and there'd been so much delay working out how to respond to it that by the time we actually carried out the counterattack, it was after midnight and was into the 25th of April. It was now the third anniversary of the original Anzac Day, and they knew, and they had an opportunity to commemorate it with a special exploit. They were tugging and straining at the leash, an officer noted. They pressed on up the slope to their first objective, where there was a brief pause while the leaders checked positioning and direction, and scouts were pushed out in front as a protective screen. These scouts detected enemy soldiers close ahead, and the 15th Brigade line was adjusted accordingly with some minor tweaks and reshaping. But this minor movement was evidently detected as German flares went up and then an enemy machine gun started firing. In response, Captain Eric Young, a 23-year-old 59th Battalion officer from St Kilda, gave the order to charge. Eric Young gave the order to charge. All the pent-up nervous energy that had accumulated during this long suspense-filled day was unleashed, and Pompey Elliott's men charged with an impromptu, uninhibited, terrifying yell. It wasn't just the 59th. The 60th and 57th men joined in as well, as the whole line surged forward with exhilarating, irresistible momentum. There was a desperate hail of machine gun and rifle fire from the Germans, but the raw, spontaneous roar in the dark alarmed them, and their shooting was generally inaccurate. And what also contributed to this is that our blokes were charging slightly uphill, So the Germans here, sort of firing straight ahead, tended to go over their heads. Yeah? So that helped them too. Many Germans were caught by surprise and overwhelmed as Pompey's men penetrated deep into enemy-held territory. And the southern, that's the northern pincer, Pompey's men. The southern pincer, the 13th AIF Brigade, also had a difficult start. Their progress was severely hampered by enemy machine guns in the trees on their left. The 13th Brigade's leaders had been told that this wooded area had been cleared that afternoon by Heneker's 8th Division, but this assurance soon proved clearly incorrect as casualties accumulated. In fact, this impediment threatened to stop the brigade's advance altogether on the left of it, until a 51st Battalion detachment went directly into the trees to deal with the machine gunners. Charles Bean described this dashing and successful initiative as extraordinarily bold. Its leader, Lieutenant Cliff Sadlier, was awarded the Victoria Cross. The 13th Brigade encountered further obstacles on their way forward, more machine gun posts, barbed wire, other strong points, and casualties were significantly higher than in the 15th Brigade. So their casualties much higher than Pompey's men. But the survivors in the 13th persevered. Some of them got close to their final objective, but the leaders decided that the most prudent course of action was to fall back a bit and consolidate a position south of the centre of Villebretina. So the two pincers didn't quite manage to connect during the night, but by dawn it was clear that each formation had done enough to ensure the overall success of the daring counterattack, confounding the misgivings of even informed insiders like Charles Bean. As the news spread, the widespread anxiety dissolved into rapturous relief. In supplementary operations on April the 25th, Pompey directed the 57th Battalion to deal with the mopping up inside Villebretina and to extend the new line south to connect with the 13th Brigade. The 57th proceeded to round up so many German prisoners inside Villebretina that there were too many to supervise, but fortunately a British unit materialised to take over this task, and the 57th was able to connect up with the 13th Brigade later that day. Now, I think we've got another image here. There's Pompey. Windows can't open this picture. That was the map I was going to show you. Never mind. That is what I was up to, really. I knew there was a problem with the map. This is the one I want to show you now. This is the impressive haul of German mortars and machine guns captured by Pompey's brigade at Villebretina. So it's just two types of weaponry that they captured. The success of the counterattack not only confounded the widespread anxiety and pessimism about the perilous operation, it also denied the enemy a tactically vital objective that was never threatened again. The dangerous German thrust towards Amiens was stymied for good. This outstanding feat, based on the plan devised by Pompey Elliott, was acclaimed by numerous commanders all the way up to Generalissimo Foch at the top of the hierarchy, who raved about the altogether outstanding valiance, that's V-A-L-I-A-N-C-E, altogether outstanding valiance of the Australian brigades. Now, Pompey felt distinctly proud. If I just go back, there's Pompey. He's looking a bit proud there. But this is later in 1918, this photo. But Pompey felt distinctly proud in the immediate aftermath of Villebretina, quoting, "Birdwood and the French general said that nothing like it had been done in the war. Birdwood really tried to be nice to me yesterday when he came round about the splendid way my boys had behaved, but he rather looked as if I'd made him swallow a bit of green apple. I wore my old Australian jacket and looked as disreputable as I could too. It's a joke on these spick-and-span soldiers to show them that Australians have a few brains sometimes. General Monash, who had nothing to do with the battle himself, declared that this counter-attack at night, without artillery support, is the finest thing yet done in the war by Australians or any other troops. Unquote. And he wasn't the only one to draw this conclusion immediately afterwards. But later in 1918, the Australians accomplished other feats that might have been even better than Villers-Brett, but it is striking to consider what well-credentialed observers wrote about Villers-Brett even years later, even many years later. General Grogan, VC. He's a general and a VC winner. General Grogan, VC. He was a brigadier in Heneker's 8th British Division, so he was there. Described this successful counterattack by night across unknown and difficult ground at a few hours' notice as perhaps the greatest individual feat of the war. Grogan's staff captain in that British brigade felt it was the most wonderful performance he was familiar with in his entire war experience. There's another British officer, Neville Lytton, L-Y-T-T-O-N, Neville Lytton, who was a highly capable frontline officer who then moved on from that role during the war to have senior responsibilities at Haig's headquarters for much of the war, including April 1918. So he was very well placed to assess Villers-Brett's significance. After the war, he wrote a book that included this. The importance of Villers-Brett cannot be overestimated. The Australians made a counterattack at night, which was completely successful. One of the most astounding manoeuvres of the war. Even if the Australians had achieved nothing else during the war but the recapture of Villers-Brett, they would have won the right to be considered among the greatest fighting nations of the world. One of the battalions in Heneker's 8th British Division had an officer, Hubert Essaim, I think that's the right pronunciation, E-S-S-A-M-E, Hubert Essaim, who became a general in World War II and later a military historian. He had extensive knowledge and personal experience, including his own involvement at Villers-Brett, when he wrote a book about 1918, over five decades later, that included this. The personal ascendancy of the Australian soldier on the battlefield made him the best infantryman of the war and perhaps of all time. Oh yeah, that was the map, wasn't it? That's right. That's the one. Now, one more quote. It's a special one. I've read this out a number of times over the years. Don't know how many times you've heard this, Rosalie. Bear with me. This is a special one. Australia's first official war artist, Will Dyson, is the chap on the left, obviously, doing a sketch there, was with Charles Bean at Villers-Brett. So when Bean's going to bed at night before the counterattack and he's terribly depressed about it and thinks it's got no hope, Will Dyson's there with him, same tent. Will Dyson was with Charles Bean at Villers-Brett, and the counterattack Will Dyson was very familiar with consolidated his reverence for Australia's soldiers. And soon afterwards, he wrote a letter home to his brother in Melbourne, Edward Dyson. Some of you may know that name, Edward Dyson, the writer and journalist. If you talk about the bulletin school of the 1890s, you'd always have Lawson and Patterson as one and two, or two and one. If you went for a third, Ted Dyson might have been the third. He's a very capable writer. So Will Dyson, the artist, is writing home to brother Ted after Villers-Brett, and I've been researching World War I for 40 years now, and this remains my favourite letter of all. It says Will Dyson straight after Villers-Brett. The boys are more eager, cheerful, bucked up and full of fight than ever before. Weather is good, food is good, and they are at the height of their reputation. What they have done is in so striking a contrast to what the others did not do. God alone knows what terrible things are coming to them, but whatever they are, they'll meet them as they've met everything in the past. These bad men, these ruffians, who will make the life of Australian magistrates busy when they return, with outrages upon all known municipal bylaws and other restrictions upon the free life. They are of the stuff of heroes and are the most important thing on earth at this blessed moment. So, that's the story. That's why the words, N'oublions jamais l'Australie, never forget Australia, are prominent today at the school at Villabretina, commemorating what happened at Gallipoli in 1915 is understandable. Remembering what happened at the Western Front in 1918 is fundamental. Fundamental. Now, last page. I'll conclude with some brief remarks that may be of interest to this audience in particular about another Villabretina building that's important to Australia. Our new National Interpretation Centre, the Sir John Monash Centre, is about to be opened next month. It deals with what we did and what we experienced at the whole Western Front. And it's a reflection of the significance of Villabretina that it was decided to locate this new building covering the whole Western Front there at Villabretina. I had some involvement with it myself. At the end of 2014, I was invited to become one of the historians providing content for it. I spent quite a lot of time on this in 2015, but I've had no involvement since, so I have no idea how they have used what I provided. It seemed to me that it would have been a good idea to show us how they used that content to enable us to comment or point out flawed nuances, etc. And this was pointed out, but I haven't seen anything, so I don't know precisely how things have ended up. I can, though, make some general points about the centre, quickly. It costs a lot of money and has been a priority for our national government. Tony Abbott, when Prime Minister, was particularly keen on it. Its creation and construction have been managed by DVA, that's the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. For the creative content, DVA chose a firm of museum designers, and these designers engaged historians like me to provide the information. So DVA, or Tony Abbott, DVA, this design group, and some historians who happened to include me for a while. It has cost a lot of money, not because of the historians' wages, but because of the kind of building that it is. My first thought when I heard about its location at the Villabretina Memorial up on the hill beside the town was that having it there would jeopardise the wonderful views that you get all round from that memorial. So I was relieved to be told that this new building would be 70 or 80% underground. So that's good. But doing it that way, of course, increases the cost. Also, it's an ultra-modern, high-tech building. It's the opposite of the AWM, Australian War Memorial, where Charles Bean insisted on authenticity, and you absorb the story by seeing real objects like Pompey's boot that he wore at the landing with a bullet hole in it, where he was shot at the landing at Gallipoli. At this new Monash Centre, the story is told via modern films specially made for the centre and high-tech multimedia stuff. You know, you can walk somewhere inside the building and where you walk triggers a big screen with images and info about, say, Fromelles, if you walked on Fromelles on the map, or a loud shell burst, or you walk somewhere else and an aerial dogfight breaks out over you with planes roaring around. So it's more of an immersive experience than a traditional museum like the AWM. But the aim has been to provide a faithful coverage of what Australians endured and accomplished at the Western Front, notably at Villabretina. Thank you very much.